back to Hyphenated America, where we make immigration laws and policies easier to understand. We're two college students interested and passionate about immigration. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Maria. This week, we'll be discussing DACA, a highly contested and oftentimes confusing program. Later on in the episode, we are so excited to be speaking to Juan Escalante, who currently serves as a digital campaigns manager at FWD.us, a DC-based organization focused on immigration and criminal justice. Much of his work is targeted at ensuring the DACA program continues to protect an estimated 700,000 immigrant youth from deportation.
So, Maria, we've discussed DACA quite a bit between the two of us, and the fact that not only does it seem to always be in the news, but that there are additionally so many misconceptions about the program.
So DACA was founded in 2012 under the Obama administration. This program allows undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children before the year 2007 to apply for renewable two-year permits that protect them from deportation and allow them to work legally.
Right, and to qualify for the program, you must have been younger than 16 years old when you arrived and younger than 31 when DACA began in 2012. And I think that's also something that a lot of people talk about is you'll meet someone who might be 38 years old and there might be a hesitation to realize that they're a DACA recipient. But, you know, if they were younger than 31 when DACA began in 2012, in 2020, it makes sense. And something that USCIS also clarifies is that you must have no significant criminal record and also be enrolled in high school or have a diploma or the equivalent. It's important to note here that the program does not provide a pathway to permanent residency or citizenship for Dreamers.
Yes, you're completely right. There are definitely a lot of really specific requirements for people to qualify as DACA recipients. So there are so many people that, you know, qualify for one thing and not the other. And I think it's important for people to realize that, you know, the population of DACA out of the entire undocumented population is quite small because of these requirements. So politically, when news outlets and politicians refer to DACA, they often talk about Dreamers. DACA recipients are often referred to as Dreamers because of the Dream Act. There have been 10 versions that have been proposed since 2001. The latest version, if passed, which is now called the American Dream and Promise Act of 2019, would allow current, former, and future undocumented high school graduates and GED recipients a three-step pathway to U.S. citizenship through college, work, or the armed services.
Right. So, as you said, the Dream and Promise Act has not passed, and there have been many assaults on the program, particularly during the last couple of years from the Trump administration. President Trump actually campaigned on the desire to end DACA. He then pulled back and had some, you know, slightly sympathetic remarks on DACA recipients. DHS stopped accepting new applications for the program. But recently, in June of 2020, the Supreme Court blocked one of the administration's attempts to end the program. However, something to clarify here is that that didn't and doesn't mean the program is safe.
So yes, DACA is never safe, especially during an administration like Trump's, where this is a cultural issue as much as a legal one. And so as you mentioned, there are also a lot of recent developments with this DACA ruling. On July 28th, the acting secretary of DHS, Chad Wolf, announced that they would not accept new applications while they conducted a review of the program. This doesn't mean that DHS is attempting to rescind the DACA program, but it makes it clear that the department intends to rescind the program at a later date. And they might be doing it as well to encourage people from not reapplying or to not get the turnout that would otherwise be seen if they wouldn't make this ruling.
Absolutely. As we mentioned at the beginning of this episode, we are so excited to have immigration advocate, writer, and strategist Juan Escalante here with us today. Juan has done some really cool and inspiring work with organizations such as America's Voice and has had publications featured in the New York Times, Huffington Post, Latino Rebels, and CNBC, among others.
Juan, welcome to the podcast. We're so excited to have you on Hyphenated America, our very first episode. So thanks so much for being here.
I feel that now I'm putting myself on the spot by inaugurating this program here.
Your career in activism seemed to be deeply rooted in your experience and identity as an undocumented immigrant and DACA recipient. Can you tell us about your most memorable experiences as an activist in the last few years?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been doing this now for almost 15 years, which is insane. Namely because I started when I was 16 years old. And some of the highlight reels to me are kind of like blips in their radar, because immigration as an issue, and, you know, just in terms of advocacy, is such a, we often talk about it in the news or like in common conversations, a very polarizing and a very emotional issue. But the truth of the matter is that it's a very heavy issue. If you don't have the emotional bandwidth or the headspace to kind of like understand that, you will lose a lot of times, and you will see a lot of people be disenfranchised or targeted or deported. Then, you know, you will quickly realize that, or you burn out, or you have a different opinion as to how this issue should or shouldn't be managed. So I think for me, the main things over the past number of years have been, you know, obviously having or building kind of like a space online for people to dialogue all together. Oftentimes when we think about immigration, we think about people essentially who are often profiled by the media, and that's basically it. And to me, that couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, oftentimes individuals are their own gatekeepers of their own life experience and their stories, and they should be allowed to express themselves in the way that they so choose. So building community across the internet has been probably one of the biggest things that I've done, because, again, when I started at 16, we're talking about like 2006, 2007. Wow. Yeah, so I'm dating myself here.
But, no. I meant wow in the sense of, like, I do feel like what's so amazing is about DACA is, like, young kids kind of took a control of their own narrative, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, when I started before DACA, I mean, like six years before, I mean, 2006, 2007, Barack Obama wasn't even president. So that kind of gives you a timeline of how this has been. So in the beginning, and I think this is kind of like the building blocks of what we know now to exist, where people go online and like say that they're undocumented and are able to share their stories and beyond. But like in the very beginning, there was basically like people didn't know what Twitter was. People didn't, you know, Facebook was still kind of like in this diaper stage. And like, and even then, the whole understanding of the immigrant narrative and their story was that if you ever, you know, some of you may be familiar with this, but like if you grow up and as an undocumented person, your parents will sit you down at a table one day and be like, look, mijo, you know, we don't have papers, we don't have papeles. And if you say something to someone could come here and take us away and deport us back to Venezuela. And you kind of grew up with this fear, right? Like you are now being entrusted with this like super secret information. And if you divulge that secret, somehow you're going to become, you know, a target. So having that on you, and then having the courage or the mentality that if you somehow open the door and you send that out to the internet for people to see, who knows, right? Like you may become a target, but you can't live your life in hiding the whole time. And I think that that's probably one of the biggest things for me, is that being able to show people in the very early stages that they shouldn't be afraid and that they could essentially be able to share their own experiences online, at whatever capacity they could, whether they couldn't travel because they didn't have DACA, even when they got DACA, because they were afraid of retaliation by the government, that, you know, this is obviously a journey and that there's different ways for us to come together as community.
Definitely. I'd love to kind of dive into that more in the sense how you said, like, in undocumented communities, you know, there's such a fear that, you know, other people might find out and how that might put your family in danger. When you tell people that they should be more open and share more, do you get pushback from maybe some older family members that are like, no, that might put us in a more, you know, precarious position? Or, you know, what are kind of like, what challenges have you found with pushing that message? Because, you know, it is a scary position to be in.
Yeah, I mean, I remember one time, well, I was quoted on the local paper. I grew up in South Florida, and my mother was like completely freaked out because she basically sat down and told me, like, you know, if something happens to us because of your activism, it's going to be on you. And like, kind of like the table flipped, right? Like my parents were now telling me that like our misfortunes may be the result of my own work and passion. And, you know, I kind of told them, you know, if you want me to advance or make something out of myself, I have to do this because I can't just go about my life and, you know, telling people like, hey, like, my name is Juan Escalante and I kind of want to go to college, but I don't have papers. Do you think you can help me? No one listens to that. Like, it just, it's just such a very narrow minded and very narrow point of view for you to assume that if you just kind of whisper in between the lines that, you know, you could get lucky. I don't want to say that kind of, you know, hyper precaution doesn't help, but it doesn't have the same volume as opposed to if you start building out community and you help and show people that this is not just a Juan Escalante issue, but it's an issue that impacts, you know, almost, you know, more than a million people who came to this country as children and who unfortunately have no status, whether it's because they aged out of their parents' application, whether it's because they came here undocumented, you know, through and through, whether it's because they were victims of fraud by, or they were defrauded by a notario. You know, there's no one way to slice the narrative. And I think when you are able to show the scale and scope of it, a lot of people kind of come to understand, you know, what exactly is it that they're dealing with. And, you know, in a state like Florida, I remember, you know, when I first got invited, when I first got involved in the DREAM Act and immigration issue, I remember sitting down and, you know, kind of marveling at like states like Texas and California who had like in-state tuition provisions. And Florida did not have to come, did not have such a thing until like 2014. So for me, navigating all that was also a completely different experience because I always wanted to go to college. My parents always, you know, like they basically left everything for me to get a better education. I knew that that's what I wanted, not just, you know, to honor their sacrifice, but I knew that I definitely wanted that degree. And I definitely wanted to invest in my education. So navigating those things as a person in Florida, not really knowing or being able to disclose, you know, to officials in higher education institutions, hey, I'm undocumented. Do you have like a resource center? Do you have a manual? Was definitely a challenge for me. And now that institution is a thing in the state of Florida, it's also, you know, comforting to know that students, you know, to some degree or another, are getting the help they need. There's definitely work to be still, there's work to be still done in that area, I would say.
Absolutely. And so you started to speak on the fact that, you know, DACA has changed your, you know, your activism with regards to undocumented immigrants, and DACA has, you know, altered since before the Obama administration. And with the future of DACA so unclear and tumultuous during the Trump administration, you know, what legislative action would you like to see happen with regards to DACA, you know, in a scenario where President Biden is our reality and we happen to have a democratically controlled Senate?
Yeah. You know, it's 2020. I think I have to like say that out loud because, you know, the wildest things happen, and it's just the year in and of itself has kind of become like a meme or a joke in and of itself.
Right.
So obviously anything can happen. And I say that not ironically, but I say that to kind of illustrate the fact that like, we're as of a week ago, nobody really thought that we would be in the situation that we're in, right? The Department of Homeland Security recently issued a memorandum, which basically cuts the DACA program in half, still charges $495 for renewals, which is basically, you know, the same amount for half the benefit, which has a lot of people concerned because, you know, access to the program has always been an issue specifically for people who aren't able to afford that amount of money on a regular basis. And while the future continues to be uncertain for a lot of us who are shielded from deportation under this program, I think it's important to remind ourselves of a number of things. You know, number one, yes, it's an election year. Obviously, we're dealing with a very hostile administration. The Trump administration has made no secret from the beginning that they will throw everything that they had, not just at immigrants, but refugees, political asylees, TPS holders, you know, you name it. They have essentially run the playbook on xenophobia, racism, and beyond, to try to further divide this country that's already been polarized by politics for a number of years. So having that in mind, I think there's a couple of steps in here that I think people have to obviously dwell upon before fully understanding, you know, what the scope of the problem is. Number one, it's the obvious thing. 2020 is an election year, and it just also happens to be a presidential election year. For those of us who can't vote, I'm raising my hand in my little corner of my apartment. You know, it's incumbent on us to essentially remind people that, you know, for those U.S. citizens and people who are able to vote, to get out there. You know, people's voices need to be heard, especially at a time where our democracy and our country continues to essentially face a lot of challenges by individuals who consistently challenge institutions or who appoint people to head agencies like Department of Homeland Security, USCIS, and beyond, that have real life impact on the life of immigrants or aspiring U.S. citizens. You know, just today, you know, we're talking on July 31st, we saw the major release of a USCIS rule that essentially hikes up the fees and the cost of applications. You know, starting in October, becoming a U.S. citizen is going to be ungodly costly for a lot of people.
I saw that. I think it's more than $500, and it's like... Yeah. It's a huge spike, and they don't want to take as many applications. It's really concerning.
So it's that, right? So it's things like that, and we need to make sure that the only way to change this immediately is by making your voice known at the ballot box. And then number two, as it pertains to DACA, Congress has continuously and oftentimes said that they want to fix the DACA issue, that they love Dreamers, so on and so forth. One of the biggest people, and I think one of the biggest culprits for inaction, is one of my least favorite people in the U.S. Senate, which is John Cornyn. John Cornyn is the senator from Texas. Who
yes, don't remind me.
Yeah, he often goes to the floor and it's like, you know, it was a number of weeks ago, right after the Supreme Court decision. It's like, we finally need to do something, you know, for the Dreamers, so on and so forth. And he gave this speech that if you didn't know any better, you're like, oh my God, like Republicans coming to support the immigrants. And time and time again, John Cornyn is the person who doesn't lift a finger. He just does it basically to get the headline of his, you know, in local newspapers, like John Cornyn supports Dreamers and so on and so forth. But it's also the person that at the end of the day derails any kind of immigration legislation. And this says it's like, it's everybody's fault except his. So the only way that we're going to get through this is if it's Congress kind of figures itself out. In this case, I think I can't remember whether it was Sophia or Maria who said this, but we definitely need a Democratic controlled Congress that essentially is able to break through the filibuster and pass HR6, which is essentially a bill known as the Dream and Promise Act, which will codify DACA protections and offer a pathway to citizenship for DACA beneficiaries. And then, you know, it will be incumbent on all of us, right, to also ensure that should there be a Biden administration, that the Biden administration doesn't just leave this at the bottom of their list, that they prioritize immigration as a core of their agenda in the first 100 days by reviving the program to its full extent and allowing more people to apply. So, I know I've said that, you know, there's only three things, but you can definitely see, you know, the complexity and how this is not essentially like a overnight kind of thing. This is definitely going to continue to take some time. And the only way that we can continue to do it is if people get out to vote and if undocumented immigrants, you know, old and young or whatever, continue to essentially be the people that they have been for the past decade, which is resilient, people who are out there to put everything, you know, their skin in the game, their lives, their stories, their communities up front and center by sharing their stories, their struggles, and making sure that people understand that, you know, we are real people at the end of the day, if nothing else, we're human beings who want an opportunity to continue to live in the country that our parents, our ancestors, you know, sacrificed so much for, and that we want, you know, the recognition and the opportunity to continue to just benefit of that little piece of the American dream, if that even exists anymore.
I completely agree with you, and that's so true. I think that, you know, sometimes in the politics, we can kind of, you know, forget that these are, you know, communities that, you know, are so greatly affected by these policies, and, you know, there's so much fear and there's so many real consequences to, you know, immigration platforms. So thank you for, you know, articulating that so beautifully, and, you know, the urgency to kind of, you know, expand these protections. So last question, kind of, you know, hitting on that point a little deeper, or what are common misconceptions that you see are very prevalent with regards to DACA? The comment that I'd like to make is, you know, sometimes a lot of well-meaning, left-leaning individuals think that the protections provided by DACA are enough, or that they're even generous. I don't really think that people realize how small of the undocumented population can even qualify or apply for it. So what do you think is missing from this conversation? What are, you know, misconceptions that you think are very prevalent right now?
I think the main thing is that people have this perception that DACA, and I say people, I want to make sure that I specify, you know, who we're talking about. We're talking about individuals who believe that this program is essentially a catch-all, that it fixes this problem for the time being, and that, you know, for some reason or another, it should just continue to exist. Or people who are not well-versed in the fragility of the program, right? So, like, you know, for allies who think, like, that just, you know, talking to your undocumented person, to your undocumented friend, and you're like, oh my God, like, this is so horrible. Like, I can't believe that this is happening to you. And then that's kind of like the way the conversation ends. Mm-hmm. You know,
they think that's enough. And you're like, there's so much more work to be done.
Exactly. So I often, like, especially in college, I face this issue, right? Where people kind of give you a pat on the back. It's like, don't worry, I promise to do everything in my power to help you out, and then that's it. But, like, there's no commitment, there's no next step and stuff like that. And I think people really need to understand that, you know, what we're dealing with here at hand is so fragile that losing it will be not just catastrophic for the people who currently benefit under it, but for thousands and thousands of people who are aging in. We're talking about 14, 15, 16 year olds right now who are in high school and who are facing the same dilemma that I faced when I was their age, which was, I want to go to college, and because of a stupid piece of paper that I should be able to apply to right now, I'm unable to do that, or I should be able to get a job, or I should be able to get a driver's license. And I think that essentially amplifies the scope of the problem. So I think there's two things in here. One, people don't realize, you know, how fragile this is. And two, that and in that same, you know, first bucket, is that DACA's not a law, you know? It's essentially an exercise in executive discretion, you know, that President Obama did. And because it's not a law,
constantly on attack.
Exactly. It's like Play-Doh, right? Like, you can shift it and mold it. And we see that now. You know, given the recent actions that the Trump administration has taken, legal or not, you know, we can, that could be a completely different episode in and of itself. But we see that now. We see that at the end of the day, you know, the only way to fix this is to, you know, pass legislation to Congress. And then number two is also, you know, the lack of awareness that, you know, DACA as itself is a very narrow population. You know, there's an estimated 11 million undocumented people in here, you know, like my parents. And, you know, DACA covers an estimated 700,000 people, give or take. So, you know, if you were to illustrate this in a bar chart or in a pie graph or whatever, it would shock a lot of people, essentially,
yeah,
you know,
less than
how 10%. Much was left.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in the immediacy. You know, I'm unable to vote. I think oftentimes we also get attacked on the internet, particularly. I get a kick out of people who troll me on the internet, especially on Twitter. It's like, they're just trying to try to rig the election, and there's millions of illegal voters out there. And I'm like, do you understand, like, how insane it would be for, like, just me, like say that I wanted to vote, like the amount of stuff that you will have to do to commit fraud in an election is so much to just score one vote. And for like, and also for like, for what, you know, like if we're trying to essentially exert our presence here so that we can essentially eventually become part of this, you know, democracy and participate in it. But anyways, that's a completely different sideline in here.
Definitely have you back on, even if it's just to go through your Twitter feed and help, you know, dispel some misconceptions of the people have.
Oh man, yeah, we can just devote some time to reading mean tweets that people send at me. It's hysterical.
Absolutely.
And that's our first episode. Special thanks to Juan Escalante for chatting with us.
Be sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and our Facebook page to stay up to date with the podcast. Also, be sure to check out our website, hyphenatedamerica.org, where you can access our guides, weekly breakdown of immigration news, and so much more.